a little sparse this morning, but I think we're, because the Senate goes in at 10, we're going to go ahead and start. Senate goes into session at 10 o'clock.
And they have a caucus at 9:45.
Oh, and they have a caucus at 9:45, so we're going to go ahead and start and try to get in as much before they leave. And we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5022.
Chair Minnick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe Cox, Chancellor of the University System. And just two housekeeping items. You can see on your daily topics list where we are today. We're talking about partnerships, preparation for life and work. On Monday, we break into two parts. In the morning is public testimony, and in the afternoon evening is cost effectiveness, and we'll be back with the audits and report on 271 and et cetera. What I'd like to do just very briefly in about 3 minutes, if I don't drive my slide person totally crazy, is to touch on three of the partnerships that Roger and I didn't touch on last week when we were here. I won't go back over those, but there are several that are, I think, worth at least noting. One being the Central Oregon University Center in Bend, and the tremendous progress it has made. We're now serving about 600 students. We're awarding about almost 100 degrees a year. There are 9 institutions, 2 of them private. Merrill Hurst is thinking of joining us there. We have 20-some programs, and it's really quite unique. Over on the coast in Coos Bay, in a brand-new university center, we have a current enrollment of about 300 students in 60-some courses, with, I believe, 4 institutions participating. But again, the point is to take the programs to a community college location where the students can do their first 2 years there and then move right into an upper division program, graduate, having never left that community. Now, obviously, the array of programs they have to choose from is not the full array, but we try to tailor that to their needs. The other one that I just want to touch quickly is what's happening on the North Coast. The North Coast from Newport North, where Western Oregon is in conversations with several of the community colleges there to attempt to meet some of those place-bound needs. That's a little more difficult because the population is thinly spread and there aren't great concentrations. But Western is really determined to try to meet some of those needs. The other point I would make is that roughly 3,000 Oregon Community College students transfer to one of our institutions every year. We've worked very hard at taking the bumps out of the road. It is about as seamless, I think, the community college presidents will tell you, as it can be. We work very closely with the Board of Education to try to make sure those bumps are gone. And we're actually rather proud of our record there. The Capital Center in Beaverton, another kind of partnership, and if you've not been there, I would urge you to visit it. We acquired about 7 years ago, a former and old Tektronix campus, and it has become a kind of original creation partnership between the school, 7 school districts, an ESD, Portland Community College, and the university system, where we try to bring advanced engineering and computer science and business courses directly to the heart of this very dynamic business center in Oregon. U of O, OSU, PSU, are all there. OIT is there. And it continues to be an exciting and different kind of development. You know we're involved in distance learning electronically. I'm not going to go through all those materials. They're in your file. But again, we are trying to reach people who would not be served otherwise. And we do roughly 130 to 300 courses a year, bouncing courses off the satellite or using different technologies. For the people who are place-bound, it is the difference between educational access and not at all. With that, I'd like to turn to the feature event this morning, was to have you meet some of our partners from other sectors, from the private sector particularly, and to introduce that part of the program, I would invite someone I don't think you've met. Dr. Diane Hines joined me. I lured Diane away from California State University, where she was very involved in working with the business community in California and pioneered in something called the Center for Entrepreneurial Partnership there and was very much involved in the California Virtual University. So she will lead the rest of the program this morning.
Chair Minnis, members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, I'm Diane Bynes, Vice Chancellor for Corporate and Public Affairs and Board Secretary for the Oregon University System. As the chancellor mentioned a few minutes ago, my colleagues, Dr. Shirley Clark, Dr. Bob Dryden, and I would like to outline for you today what we're doing to prepare students for their careers. Ensuring the employability of our graduates is one of our system key strategic goals. So we could spend a lot of time today describing our efforts in general in workforce preparation, but we are going to focus today on the high demand areas on meeting Oregon's future needs. At this point, Madam Chair, I'd like to invite Dr. Dryden, Mr. Jim Johnson, Dr. John Van Lune, and OGI President Ed Thompson to join me. I'll continue for a few minutes while they're getting settled. Let me expand on the theme of responsiveness. As you know, one of our major efforts is to be more responsive to the needs of the economy and the private sector. You've been hearing a lot about this week. Tom Imason, the board president, in his remarks, pointed out Monday that our labor market is in the midst of a major transformation, and we are trying to respond appropriately to that transformation. If you look at the slide, this happens to be slide 11, page 11 of your documents, if you don't want to look at the board here. If you look at this slide, you'll see that thousands of new jobs will be added to Oregon's economy in the next decade. More than one in four of these new jobs are going to require a bachelor's degree or better. This slide actually lists those occupations that will require a four-year degree and better, and tracks their growth between 1996 and 2006. As board member Herb Ashkenazi indicated on Monday, our charge from the 2010 panel was to anticipate the needs of Oregon and then meet those needs. Okay. Preparing students for success in Oregon's emerging knowledge-based economy is clearly one of those critical state needs. I'm sure that you'll recall that employability of our graduates is one of our four strategic goals for the entire university system. If you look at a profile of our recent graduates, it shows that we're starting from a strong base with 90%, and this is slide 12 for you, with 90% of our bachelor's graduates and 96% of our advanced graduates entering the workforce immediately rather than going on to school, and mostly in Oregon in professional and managerial jobs. This is good news for Oregon. Slide 13 talks about the enrollment. Our enrollment is also growing in the high-demand disciplines of computer science, engineering, and engineering-related technology. This slide shows the growth in enrollment in these disciplines in the past and the anticipated growth in the next biennium. You'll note that we hope to increase the FTE, and this is not headcount, this is FTE enrollment, by almost 400 students between 1997, 1998, and 2001. Although the job growth in agriculture, forestry, and fishing is going to stem largely from replacement needs, Oregon is expected to maintain its comparative advantage in its natural resource base well into the next century. And employment is expected to increase beyond replacement needs in the areas of biotechnology, environmental science, and food processing. Slide 14 gives you the Oregon University System enrollment in natural resource disciplines, shows you that it has been gradually climbing in the 1990s, and is expected to continue climbing into 2000 and 2001. With that context, I'd like to turn to Vice Chancellor Dryden at this point to introduce the members, the people who will be speaking to you.
Chair Minnis, members of the joint,
just before we do this, I would like to alert us as members of this body to a problem related to the veterinary medicine program at OSU. Since the program has been in place, that program has relied on the cooperation of Washington State University to educate the students in a couple years of the four-year program. And the relationship with Washington State is not in a good situation now, and It's increasingly a burden on students to have to go to Washington State to do part of that degree program. So it's not a problem I think we can handle now, but I think it's a problem that we need to think about in the future so that we can make sure that this program is effective and meets the needs of the students. I just wanted to alert us to that.
Thank you, Senator Joe.
Chair Minnis, members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this morning. For the record, I'm Bob Dryden, Vice Chancellor for Engineering and Computer Science with the Oregon University System. Now my pleasure to introduce Don Van Leeuwenhoek, Chief Executive Officer and President of Electroscientific Industries in Portland. Don is also served as the founding chair of the Engineering Technology and Industry Council that was established with Senate Bill 504.
Thank you, Bob, and I too am delighted to be here to talk to you about what's been done. On my right is Jim Johnson, Oregon Site Manager and the current chair, Oregon Site Manager for Intel, current chair of the Engineering Technology Industry Council. And on my left is Ed Thompson, the president of OGI, and you'll hear from them throughout this. Ed, the first slide, please. I want to thank many of you who participated 2 years ago in taking the risk to give $5 million for investment to the Engineering Technology Industry Council. It was an interesting first experience, but I was very pleased with the very rapid cooperation and working together spirit, and I'll talk about some of the sub-programs. There's some things that I think none of us forecast would go as well as they've gone. We came to some conclusions in the late calendar 97, and the E-Board approved our recommendations. And I'd like to go right into what's been done. Next slide, please. Let's put it all up, and then we'll have everything there. Good. The first program was to increase graduate engineering capacity in the Portland area. $1.5 million was allocated to hire 4 new faculty members at PSU and OGI in the critical areas for the industrial development. The status as of today is that we've hired 3 at OGI and 1 at PSU and high-quality people. Next, please. Thank you. The next was to develop some new relevant graduate-level programs for delivery in the Portland area. $500,000 was allocated for this with the objective of developing 15 courses. A couple of things. First, we got 16 courses for that amount of money, not 15. We developed a competitive process for requests for proposals that have really fed competitive spirit and cooperative spirit among the institutions. And of the 16 courses, 14 have already been offered. And with this, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Thompson to talk a little bit about the MOGAS movie.
Thank you, Don.
Pick one, I guess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ed Thompson, President of Oregon Graduate Institute of Science and Technology. FD 504 invested public funds in the Oregon Graduate Institute in recognition of OGI's special mission to the high technology industry in Oregon. OGI received approximately $2 million to build capacity to serve the most pressing needs of Oregon's high tech industry. The funds were used to hire 3 new faculty in electrical computer engineering and electronic materials engineering with no long-term continuing public obligation. OGI created new courses for working engineers in electrical and computer engineering, computer science and engineering, and electronic materials engineering. OGI became a full partner in the Oregon Masters of Software Engineering and Industry Internship programs. An additional $3 million was contributed to these programs by private donors, further stretching the public investment in OGI. Direct state investment in OGI has produced new levels of cooperation and collaboration with the state's public institutions. For example, cross-listing of courses in electrical and computer engineering and computer science and engineering with PSU. Collaborative program planning at the department level in the Portland area. Joint sponsorship of academic seminars in the Portland area. New collaborative research opportunities have been created. The 1997 legislature laid a strong foundation for growing Oregon's capacity to meet the demand for engineering education. This was a major accomplishment designed to deepen and broaden Oregon's capacity to support the needs of the high-tech industry. $5 million was well invested. Higher education, both public and private, is working together. We have a strong start. We need to continue the good work by supporting continued investment for engineering education. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. I just want to say that's encouraging. I think it's important to make that sort of contribution to graduate engineering education. But I believe also that there's a huge demand, student demand, for more undergraduate engineering education. And that can be served at Oregon State by expanding those programs there, as well as at Portland State by expanding those programs. And so I think that if we're going to meet the needs of the future, we ought to think about the undergraduates. The undergraduates, generally speaking, come out of that program, they're ready to be hired, and they often get hired at very good living wage salaries, in fact, better than their professors often get paid.
Right.
Let's move into the next slide, okay?
If I could ask one question, Bradley. Thank you. The $1.5 million to hire the core faculty, was that appropriation enough to get them a two-year deal? Or what are we talking about there?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, from OGI's point, it was enough to hire them and get them started. The typical need in OGI's case is approximately 3 years to ramp a faculty member up to the point where they're self-sustaining. And so we would be looking for money for at least another one more year. But it's usually a three-year ramp up.
So we can say then, if I may follow up, and then the $1.5 million was enough to hire them for 3 years?
For 2 years.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, we have made a commitment to continue support of those positions.
Thank you. Well, the third activity was $250,000 to build the equivalent, the graduate equivalent of the very successful MECOP program. We started the program and have already hired a program director, Marcia Fisher. We have 11 corporate partners signed up as of today, 19 internships established, and 72 student applications. So it's moving forward quite nicely. It turns out that the program is attractive to students, and it's supplied access to some great potential employees for the partnership members, and we think that that number both of internships available and corporate partners is increasing as we sit here.
Madam Chair, would you please remind the committee members what MECOP stands for, what this program is?
Dean Dryden?
Yes, the MECOP program, Chairman and Representative Roth, MECOP stands for Multiple Engineering Co-op Program.
As an employer, we think it brings bright youngsters into the work environment early and helps them shape their education to be even more successful when they come out of school. Okay, let's move to the next one. We also talked about starting a collaborative statewide program, creating a master's in software engineering. And this perhaps is a model of the cooperation among industry and between institutions that we'd like to duplicate in the future. We allocated $2.25 million for this program. To date, the degree has been approved at OGI, OSU, PSU, and University of Oregon. 14 courses have been delivered. There's four courses going on right now in this new discipline, and we're serving 237 students, and this is in less than 2 years from the start. And the last of this group was $500,000 to fund an advancement of OIT's Opt for Co-op program. And we viewed this program as having some special attributes. It reaches into the high school to start to expose the students to the potential of high-tech jobs, what really goes on in a working engineer, a working software, a working physicist person. To date, we have 74 students involved. 25 from high school, 18 PCC, and 31 at OIT. program director has been hired starting May 1st. This really is the bridge program that spans community college, reaches into the high school, and I think will help create some increased awareness and interest in the really high-paying jobs and quite interesting jobs in high tech. Okay, next slide. I think if you look at the results of the SB 504 funding over the last 2 years, we've really had success on all fronts. I was proud to be part of the startup, but I want to emphasize the work was done by just a great group of people in our public higher ed and private higher ed and in industry. And the group is an energizing group to see work, and I would encourage you, if you happen to be around at a meeting, to stop by and see it. And next. And I think that the real focus under Jim Johnson's leadership is to continue the leveraged investment strategy.
Okay.
I am Jim Johnson, both with Intel and also the new chairman of the Engineering Technology Council. And what I'd like to talk about is what's next or what we're proposing for next to be next. Before I get into specifics of that, I want to just again reiterate the importance of engineering in high tech to the state. By and large, the tech sector is a very well-paying sector. Average wages are in the high $50,000 a year range, and just reading an analysis of Oregon's tax revenue, and 15% of Oregonians that make greater than $60,000 pay 50% of the personal income tax in the state. So clearly investing in engineering programs yields jobs that are very high paying and high leverage for the state, and therefore they pay themselves back very quickly. Actually, one of the things I think I'm going to take on is to actually get an ROI analysis that can show to you that when you invest in an engineering program for a student here in Oregon, what that yields back to the state in terms of income. And I'm sure we'll be able to show a very positive ROI on that kind of investment. Also, look at the fundamentals of our economy and where's the economy going to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Clearly, high tech is going to be everywhere. I mean, the personal computer was introduced, less than 20 years ago, and now today it's everywhere. The internet is now becoming an important force that will affect every business, from farming all the way, to high tech itself. And so every community in Oregon is going to be affected by high tech, and we all want to participate in that. I think it's important that our kids have, an opportunity to be educated in our state and be able to get good paying jobs in our state. So we believe investing in engineering yields that. The Engineering Council has put together a proposal. Hopefully all of you have seen this. It's a detailed proposal of what it is that we're asking for, by program, by result. Just as Don has demonstrated with the first $5 million.
Excuse me, when did you pass it out?
Most of you individually and passed it out, but we can get it. If anyone has not gotten it, we can get you one.
Right away. Okay.
We
get a lot of paper.
What we have proposed in here is an expansion of the investment. So we had a $5 million initial investment here, and what we're proposing is a $24 million investment, and then industry would match on top of that an additional $9 million. So for $34 million investment. We want to expand the investment from primarily a focus, as we saw, on graduate level to one that would include graduate level, would include research, and would also include undergraduate level. Because, again, we need to get more engineers. So the $24 million, what it gets us is, first of all, accountability and industry involvement. I cannot overemphasize what Don has mentioned earlier and Ed has mentioned about the cooperation. When I first entered into this process, I was expecting a rather parochial view as we talked with each of these institutions. And what I got was just the opposite of that. I mean, all the way to, I was in a meeting a month ago with Ron Adams, who's the Dean of Engineering at OSU, reviewing research programs at Intel, and we grant quite a few research programs, very few of those going to Oregon. Ron was here trying to figure out how Oregon State could get some of that money. And at the end of the meeting, he concluded what we need to do is get all of the Oregon institutions together with Intel to review how we can get more money funneled from Intel into the Oregon institutions. He could have easily just said, let's have a meeting with OSU. That's all that people were at your initial meeting. He initiated bringing all of the institutions together. So, again, I'm seeing that kind of cooperative spirit at all levels, and I think that's really important. The other element that I also think is important is, again, one of accountability. Once the budget is finalized, just as we did with 504, we will come back and say, this is how we're going to invest the money, this is the way we're going to measure it, and then we measure it, and we'll report back to you exactly how we're going to do. Again, we think that's very important. The word investment is also very important. We're not asking for a continuum of funds between now and, you know, the rest of all time. We're asking for investment money, and again in the report you'll see we state how much money we need for the investment, do we need any follow-on investment, and what you'll see is about 90% of the funds are only for the first 2 years, and then beyond that, nothing. So again, it's an investment, not a long-term commitment on your part, and we think that's critical. And the way these programs get funded long-term is, again, with the system that tuition is going to follow the student. So now what we are with the $24 million is, again, a matching of $9 million from industry. We think it's very important for industry to get much more involved in this, not just with our people, but also with our money. And we are willing to sign that up. Actually, of all, you know, going around the state and talking to other high-tech executives, I think the $9 million match is going to be one of the easier fundraising activities we're going to have to do. So I'm very optimistic that we can do that. Actually, I think we'll exceed that. The specific goals that we're looking for out of this is, again, now grow our undergraduate capacity by 10%. So you saw the enrollment figures there. I mean, that to us is extremely important. We want to encourage young people to consider the sciences and engineering, and we would like to turn that into a terms of an explicit 10% improvement in enrollment. Second objective is we want to continue to grow at the graduate level. You know, the technology is moving very rapidly. You know, 2/3 of Intel's revenues come from products that were not in existence 2 years ago. And this is for, you know, a $28 billion company. We're talking about very rapid turnover. Our engineers go through similar kinds of, well, they've got to be refreshed constantly. So lifelong learning is critical. And for us, OGI has been in the Fordham metropolitan area, has been critical in fulfilling that need of allowing our engineers to continue their education. So we need to grow the number of continuing education students by 20%, and then the number of actually degreed engineers needs to, you know, master's degrees and PhDs by 10%. We also want to begin to more rapidly expand the research side of the university system and private industry. If we look at the university system and their research numbers, you'll find that it's very high, 90% comes from the federal government, very little comes from industry. We'd like to begin to turn that around, and a lot of that matching dollars that you see in there are patterned after the Metals Initiative, which, again, the state, for every dollar the industry puts up, the state put up a dollar, and it goes into the research of joint projects in the university system. We think that's a wonderful program. We're very supportive of that program. We'd like to expand that program to also include other high-tech elements. And then we also just need to build our capacity of our facilities. With our a key part. You'll find that there's the only, I'll call it, capital investment in the program is one to help expand some classroom space at PSU because we think, again, it's important. We're running into just, you know, space limitations. And the OK Center that was mentioned over at 185th in Beaverton, that is a wonderful facility, and I think long-term we're also going to need to invest in that because, again, the thing that I think is, you know, also extremely encouraging about the Masters of Computer Science is that it is being taught by professors from all of the different universities in the state, not, I mean, all the technical universities in the state. So what we're delivering to those students is not just a very good education. We're delivering the best education that can be delivered to an Oregonian. So if the best professor from TSU, that professor teaches the class. The best professor is from OSU, that professor teaches the class. The best professor is at OGI, that teacher teaches the class. So what the students are now getting is the best Oregon can deliver. I believe in the long run that can keep Oregon's education system competitive with the larger institutions. And you look at the Stanfords or the Berkeleys or the Carnegie Mellons of the world. The only way that a state of our size and of our financial means can compete with them is we've got to bring all of our resources together. And we're beginning to see that. What's continuing our investment in engineering will do is allow that notion to expand beyond just the master's of computer science into other areas of engineering. And I believe it's a model that I'm hoping we'll be able to replicate it in all disciplines across our state as we begin to deliver a higher level of education to our kids. So that's a summary. And are there any questions I'd like to just
mention? Jim Johnson, thank you for the work you've done already on the council. And I know you've heard this before, but you have big shoes to fill. And Keith Thompson and Don Van Leeuwenhoe, but I've known Keith as a personal friend for over 18 years. And I tell you, your company in town is certainly a good neighbor. And they're so important to this state and to my Washington County with your 11,000 employees right there on four campuses, and it's really do appreciate it. I can remember last session, of course, on 504, there was a lot of skepticism that, yeah, that money will just be sucked up by the Oregon University system. We'll never hear any more about it. But not so. And I can remember being with Gordon Moore, the founder and president emeritus of Intel, when he provided $1.5 million for to enhance that program. And thank you so much. And Don Leeuwenhoe, thank you. But I have a new job for you now that you've done such a good job as council president. What I want you to do now that you are on the member of the State Board of Higher Education is to do the very same thing for teacher education, the partnering between the public and the private. And I tell you, Betty, a young blood, is we've had good conversations, but we're going to need 2 million additional teachers very soon. And we want to get our best and brightest high school students become teachers, just like we're making a good effort to have them get into engineering. And I tell you, I know now, based on what you've done with the Council of Engineering, that we can do it if we can develop a Council of Teacher Education and partner. We've got, I believe, 16 private institutions of higher education. OGI is one, but we can do a magnificent job in getting our best young people, Oregon High School graduates, to enter into the profession. And everything we're doing here in terms of education must be teacher-driven if it's going to succeed. I'm talking about school reform, charter schools, and all that. So I'm looking forward. 2 years from now, I'll be back here. You'll be back here and tell us how you've done.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your confidence. Thank you. I'll sign up for doing the best job I can. We're dead on.
I just want to appreciate what Senator Hartung has said, but also to remind us that the best way to get the best and the brightest in is to make sure that the rewards for teaching are there, including salaries, and the salaries are adequate to compete with engineers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, with your permission, I'd like to introduce our next panelist, who will describe another special area of public-private partnership that's very related to the engineering and computer science effort because they've been working closely together, and that is the Oregon Metals Initiative.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to introduce to you Kathleen Dotton, who is president of Dotton and Associates in Portland, and she'll be talking about the Oregon Metals Initiative.
Chair Menace, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Kathleen Dotton. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Metals Initiative program. And I want to start out by thanking you for all your hard work on this particular subject. I feel like I'm a beneficiary of that in a number of ways. One is OMI is clearly benefited by the work of the Engineering Council and appreciate that. But as important as that is, I'm a mom of a son who's at Southern Oregon majoring in science. So thank you. And I'm pleased my son can go to school here in Oregon and get a quality education. Let me start a little bit, if I may, by giving you some background information about the Oregon Metals Initiative. I have passed out to you some information which you may have already seen. This is a program that I think serves as one of the finest examples of partnership between industry and the university systems that we have here in Oregon. It has started, the partnership started in 1990. And since that time, it's been highly successful and innovative in terms of working with the institutions. And one of the things that it has done is created it, an opportunity for not only the metals companies, our metals companies in Oregon, to be competitive, but also for the research institutions in Oregon to be competitive. And this has been very successful all the way along. As I said, the OMI started in 1990. There are 20 companies that are now participating in it. These are companies, metals companies, that are from all around the state of Oregon. And they are high-paying jobs, much as the high-tech industry professors. So are the metals industry. The average wage for the metals industry is about a third higher than the average private sector salary. These are good jobs, jobs that students can enter as they leave from high school. There is a workers shortage in this program or in the metals industry, and this program helps us address that. Some of the companies that participate in the OMI are Precision Castpart, Ormat Wacheng, Esco Corporation, Oregon Steel Mills, Blount Cutting System, Planar, Boeing, and Oregon Ironworks. There are a number of other companies that I'm sure that you've heard. There's also other companies that are not specifically metals companies, but participate because of the metals-related research that has been involved. PGE has been one, and at different times in the past, Tektronix has also been involved in the program. One of the things that I would like to emphasize is that OMI is a tremendous example of leveraging state dollars. Since its formation, the industry has brought into the university system $10 million since 1990. That has been matched by $10 million on the state side. So there has been a dollar-for-dollar match since this program has existed. And quite honestly, there has been more money than industry has been willing to put up. I mean, industry is clamoring for this research and has found it very successful in working with the universities and wants to continue the relationship. Part of the next slide, I guess what I would like to touch base on are a couple of the examples of some of the benefits that we have seen from this partnership. And I could cite a number of them, most of which I probably don't fully understand, to tell you the truth. When you put a room of scientists together, I'm a little over my head in some of this. But clearly one of the things which I've touched on is that the high-wage jobs and the skilled workforce that this program delivers. Part of what has happened with OMI is that it is a demonstrated program. It's one of the programs which you can really see that it has been industry-driven. Sometimes, quite honestly, that's taken us a little longer maybe to work some of the processes through, but industry is guiding us. They're determining what research they want, what they need, and directing the universities to do that and encouraging to build up their resources and their training in specific areas that then in turn benefits the company. So a lot of cases, those people who have been trained through this program then return to the companies and are hired by the metals companies after the fact. It's been very successful. Let me give you a couple examples of some of the results of the training that has happened. And one of the things that was very exciting, and this happened back in 1996, had to do with some metal compounds that were, I don't know if discovered is the right word, but were able to be dealt with in a way that they uniformly shrink when heated. And this is something that has had a number of applications. It receives a award for one of the top 100 scientific discoveries back in 1996. Another of the areas that research has really benefited to and helped us in Oregon is that OMI research created new techniques for processing titanium for high temperature uses, and this has allowed the production of aerospace castings, the first aerospace castings in the world. So, in closing, I just want to say, again, this is a demonstrated project. It has worked for 10 years. We would like to see it continued. We're here today to support the higher ed budget and appreciate the partnership that we have been able to build with all of the universities. We would like to see OMI memorialized in some way or formalized through the budget process, either through perhaps a budget note or either in some way where it might be a letter of memorandum of understanding between the higher ed and our organization. But as I said, we have been very supportive of the process and appreciate the partnership. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
And could you just walk us through how the partnership works?
Sure. Generally what happens is there will either be a concept or an idea that is developed by the universities or by the companies themselves. And they will meet almost on a one-on-one basis, or if the company has it, they may approach a couple of the universities and say, look, you know, we've got this idea, we really need this developed, we want this to happen here in the state, can you help us with that? And then the universities will come back with a proposal, basically, and they'll agree on a certain dollar amount. There's at that point, they submit those requests to the board at OMI, and they go through a process of selecting the various research projects and have some formalized criteria in terms of how they determine that. The priority is generally given to, because of the particular program, to metals companies, and then if there are funds, matching funds and resources available, they may be metals research, but for non-metals, specifically metals companies that follow from that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much for coming today. We have two additional areas of high demand employment to cover this morning with you. I'd like to mention that the theme so far has been the rapid change underway in our safe economy, especially in terms of high technology. But Oregon's natural resource industry is still a very important part of our labor market and our economy, and is likely to remain so. So in addition to what we've seen already, we have important research within the university system using the latest technology to reshape our approach to agriculture and other resource-related industries in Oregon. The next panelist to present is Mr. Ron Miller. Is Ron here?
There you are.
Come on up. You may want to sit next to that mic. Or, yeah. Ron, Mr. Miller is president of Mount Jefferson Farms here in Salem, and he's going to talk about value-added agriculture. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Minnis and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to take a little bit of your time this morning. Now that Don Van Leeuwenhoek has left, I'd like to add to an assignment that Senator Hartung was talking about as he was talking about the need for a couple million more teachers and raising the pay level of those teachers. We have kind of a phrase in agriculture that's called the grain of agriculture, which I'm beginning to hear a lot more about, which means that folks like me in their mid-50s are apparently about to turn over 75% of our land to their generation behind us. And the problem is, I don't know where that generation is. They're not paid well enough to want to come into it, even though they're fabulously educated at in the Oregon University system. But if Don could find a way to make agricultural natural resources a lot more profitable and to find that 50 to 60,000 new employees and owners of agricultural land that we need, the state is really going to benefit. And since he's not here, I could maybe add that assignment.
Certainly. You my guest.
Well said. Thank you. I am Rob Miller. Mount Jefferson Farms is my company. We do a lot of new crop research, a lot of contract research, a lot of just custom agriculture and normal types of agriculture, even including the only other tea farm in the United States, which I'm not sure I want to talk a lot about because I think we have to go a little farther, but there's some really interesting opportunities in that area. We have brought new crops from all over the world here, mostly in the essential oil business, and there's a totally untapped resource and opportunity there for those new farmers we're looking for that are younger and more energetic than I am. It's all about high tech and agriculture and value adding, and the need is just unbelievable and the opportunity is unbelievable. And I talk just as briefly as I can about some of the facts of value added agriculture and what we really would like to have out of the Oregon University system. Why is this so important in Oregon? Well, it's because Oregon is about 72% driven by the service business economy, and that doesn't allow much exporting, and it doesn't allow a lot of value adding, even though it's an incredibly important thing to us. Agriculture, which includes timber, can be highly value added, and of course is exportable. About 18% of Oregon's economy is directly related to raw products. 80% is exported, and 60%, for example, the Port of the Portland's exports are food. We produce about $3.4 billion worth of economic crop activity in a year. Value-adding this is about another $2 billion. The Oregon Ag Experiment Station adds about $120 million per year in value, and the Extension Service about another $40, which we can very easily double to about $320 million worth of value-added. Agricultural businesses, another couple $1 billion. There's 140,000 jobs that are directly related to agriculture today, and these are in transportation, storage, marketing, and ag services. Ag research, of course, leads to new knowledge disseminated in the classroom and new practices and products. The approximately $6 billion, 140,000 jobs, and creation of new knowledge makes up the first and most quantifiable of three levels of value-added agriculture to Oregon. But as large as this is, it might be the least important to all of us. The second category is the value-added agriculture base and the natural resources base in Oregon and what that might mean. If you put that or try to put that into dollars, about half of Oregon is forest land. It's about 28 million acres. About 24 million of that is good commercial forest land. There's about 31,000 self-employed farmers in the state that also have a lot of timber on it. And there are about 71,000 farms and about 18 million acres in agriculture. You try to put a value on that, it's interesting to do that, but that probably is a base asset value of about $60 billion if you use about $1,500 per acre times that natural resource base. So it may be cheating a little bit, but I don't know why we can't say that $60 billion that's increasing on an annualized value basis of as little as 2% is creating about an extra $1 billion worth of value to the state of Oregon just by itself. Farmers can help to value add even their forestry partners because while our commercial timberland has dropped about $5 billion a year in their annual cuts, forestry off of primarily farmland has increased their cuts 300%. So this is value added by farmers in the forestry segment, which obviously the trend is very important compared to the decline. A large part of the value of our base is water. Much of the water exists today in Oregon in the form of storage, and as we know, most of that storage has come because it was agriculturally oriented in the first place, power and agriculture. There's about 1.7 to 2 million acres of Oregon farm ground that's irrigated, and 50% of the crops are value added by irrigation. There's a lot of value that comes from this, but agriculture, frankly, is the least beneficiary of this. In the Willamette Basin, for example, 33% of the total water in the basin is used by agriculture, but most of the water, at least two-thirds, is used by other than agricultural uses, public and all in industrial uses. So it's easy to say that agriculture has driven a lot of the extra capacity, and it is value-adding the rest of the state of Oregon because we're only using a third of the water. And a further irony here might be that while agriculture continues to increase the efficiency, gaining about 74 million gallons a day through decreased irrigation, this has been more than offset by the use of the other segments that are increasing their use. And I said 74 million, I meant $740 million gallons a day of increased efficiency has come through agricultural reduction in their pumping. But 750 million gallons a day has been an increase in use by the cities and other industrial users. So agriculture is certainly value adding in their use of a very important asset. I'm going to stop there before I go into the second and hopefully a little quicker segment and ask if there's any question on what might be the quantifiable or numerical aspects of value added agriculture.
This would be really, I think, valuable for us to have that statement with all those facts and figures, and I don't see it in our materials.
You don't have it. So we'll, with Mr. Miller's permission, we'll get that for you by tomorrow.
Thank you
very much.
I'm
Madam
Chairman. Let's see, Rob, you were on the State Board of Higher Education. You're not presently on. I didn't think I was, but I guess I'm not.
Yeah.
I've been asked to come back and be on the budget committee, but I'm not a member of the board. You're correct.
And you were just chairman of a task force on the Willamette River Basin?
My brother.
Okay. Well, I'll thank your brother then for that good work. And one thing you didn't mention that I think is an extremely important part of what we've done so far is the Food Innovation Center in Portland. It's the only urban extension work in the United States, and that is where we are going to really raise what over 220 different agricultural products, and there's so much opportunity to add value to those through the Food Innovation Center.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'm going to just rush through the second part, but it maybe is the most important part in the conclusion. But quality of life issue related to natural resources is my third category, and it's the one that perhaps is the one that we don't think about quite enough. It relates to our daily quality of life and what we want all of Oregon to look like. While the first two categories were somewhat quantifiable, this one probably is not because it's priceless. No other economic sector in the state, I believe, has the contributory power to quality of life as does agriculture and natural resources. The green that we see, the beauty that we remember most, the places we seek out in our spare time are predominantly not urban. We look for parks with trees, not streets with trees. We fish in streams and not city ponds. Our children remember far better wilderness camping over backyard camping. A good night out generally includes a good food and beverage as a common ingredient. That agriculture, forestry, and the water, land, and clean air that are the ingredients that make our work economically possible are also the most attractive ingredients to our Oregonians' quality of life. When we really talk about quality of life, we really basically talk about what we see and feel and do in our time off, and that's agriculture and natural resources. The point I'd like to make is that the stewards of our agricultural and natural resource management and assets
are the Oregon University system. They are the managers. They are the creators of the value. They are the people that are most in our lives related to whether we're have success or failure with those assets. It's the School of Agriculture, the Experimentation System, the Extension Service, the Food Innovation Service. That is where the management and the expertise and the professionalism and the research comes to make that successful. And it is probably the most important thing as far as Oregonians' quality of life. And my biggest fear or paranoia, I guess, is that while we're being asked in the natural resources arena to do huge things, enhancement of salmon, restoration, water quality, forest harvest and forest protection, cheap food, higher wages, on and on, it is possible. It is possible that this committee and the legislature as a whole might conclude over the days of these hearings and others that once again funding isn't possible for the system to the degree that we need. The full $100 million, and this I have not been asked to say this, but it is just so obvious to me, not only in natural resources, but as an ex-member of the higher ed board and an interested Oregonian and a citizen. The full $100 million is the minimum that we need for the transition to this new cost-based system. And it even at that isn't enough. It doesn't fully cost or fully fund the programs, and it does not fund our depreciation. But it's a start, and it's a fulfillment of a promise with your predecessors that needs to be honored without rewarding serious restructuring with adequate funding. We will spend this money wisely if you will get it to us. We will jumpstart our Food Innovation Center in Portland in agriculture and natural resources. We'll develop our wine industry. We'll increase food safety. We'll deal with forest products. We'll do watershed restoration. We'll work with areas in family and youth development and allow moral counties. On and on and on. We will be the best stewards and managers of those funds, but we absolutely have to have them. And I want to say, I don't think you can take the approach that you're going to give these funds out equally to everybody that wants them. But we have waited so long. We have worked so hard. We have set goals. We've audited every state university and college. We've audited the chancellor's office. We have restructured our system. We've looked at privatization. We've privatized OHSU. We have the new budget model based on costing. We just have to have the dollars to implement this, and it's going to mean so much to our state in quality of life and economics if we can get it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you so much.
I am under this, it's clear that under the governor's budget, these programs are not fully funded. What would you do?
Thank you. Is Bill here? Or Bill, would you like to put that question? Yes. Okay.
Under the governor's budget, it's clear that these programs are not going to be fully funded.
Well,
what would you do?
What I would say to the committee is that the investment to start the process, to get us started with this new model, would take us roughly halfway, and so a good deal of the resource in building up the model itself goes to support the instructional programs, particularly in the higher cost areas, of which agriculture is one. So the model itself directly puts additional funding into engineering, into computer science, and into the natural resource based fields. It would continue the statewide public services at current level. But there's no increase at the $73 million level above CSL. At the next level, there is an additional increase, and at the original 116, we had submitted two decision packages, they're now called public policy option packages. I haven't done that down. Policy option packages. Decision packages made more sense to me. But in this phasing of phase one of the model implementation, those didn't make funding, either in engineering or the expansion of the statewide.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I'd like, with your permission, I'd like to introduce Dr. Shirley Clark, who is here to speak on another important area of high demand employment in Oregon, and that's teacher education.
I'm going to go ahead. The Senate's going to be going in at 9:45. We're going to go to 9:45,
okay,
and then have them back.
Thank you. I'm Shirley Clark, Chancellor for Academic Affairs. We understand that we'll have an opportunity to come back to this important topic probably on Wednesday morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
We just wanted to remind you that Monday is public testimony time, and then Monday evening is our additional testimony. So thank you very much for allowing us to be here.
Thank you.